21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Tonight's show is dedicated to my dear friend Heinz Edelman, the creator of the Beatles' Yellow Submarine and a graphic designer, awarded the Master Series Award by his peers at the Visual Arts Foundation in New York City in 2005. Edelman passed into the spirit worlds last Tuesday, July the 21st, at the age of 75 in Stuttgart, Germany. And listeners to 21st Century Radio were the first in decades to hear the voice of Heinz Edelman, who loathed talking about the Yellow Submarine. He and I, however, immediately became close friends when I first contacted him for an interview about Yellow Submarine, and after turning down hundreds of other interview requests, he gradually warmed up to talking again about what we learned and had actually learned a lot of painful things that he experienced in his life. So, despite the fact that it was not his best work, according to Heinz, it is impossible to eulogize Heinz Edelman without emphasizing the Yellow Submarine. It was a rushed production, and Edelman worked overtime so many hours that he grew deathly ill and nearly lost his eyesight. Knowing this only increases our appreciation for the hundreds of enduring designs from Pepperland to the Blue Meanies that he cranked out around the clock for the rushed and underfunded production. After Yellow Submarine, Edelman evolved and perfected his style, working almost exclusively in Europe, designing popular posters, thousands of books, magazines, films, and inspiring countless students through his teaching. He retired several years ago as a full professor after 30 years at the Stuttgart Academy of Fine Arts. Rightly regarded as one of his generation's major contemporary graphic artists, Edelman's characteristic visual language set him above transient trends and fashions. One of his peers, New York designer Milton Glaser, said, quote, "To think of him in terms of the Yellow Submarine is really to parochialize his talent. He developed since then, and his work has changed. I know that he would like to forget about the Yellow Submarine," end quote. The next time you have the time or the tune of the Yellow Submarine stuck in your head, remember Heinz Edelman, the creative genius who invented all of Pepperland, and more importantly, all the ingenious Blue Meanies like the Apple Bonkers, the Snapping Turtle Turks, Kinky Boot Beasts, and the Dreadful Flying Glove. Then take the time to check out the rest of his wide-ranging catalog of designs and prepare to be intrigued and delighted. He will be sorely missed by everyone who appreciates the power of graphic design to compel a societal movement and a shift in consciousness. May your spirit soar high, Brother Heinz. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD hanging out here in this part of the universe. But as you probably know, it's a multi-universe. And, of course, our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Courtney. Our engineer is Jake Bryant. I was first attracted to the Woodstock event because of its original name, an Aquarian Exposition. And anything to do with Aquarius, in my mind, can't be negative. There was only one book on the 1969 event that I wanted to obtain, and that was published in 1994, and it was less than a year ago that I saw it on an auction, and I coughed up my $150, and I won it. And lo and behold, among its last and final pages, I found the same photograph taken by Rolling Stone magazine of the bus that I painted, the light bus, and that was a great surprise. As a matter of fact, my mentor, Dr. Abraham Maslow, would say it was a peak experience. Now, the author of that book, Woodstock 1969, the first festival, was Elliot Landy, and it's 40 years later, and joining us tonight is Elliot Landy to discuss his new book, Woodstock Vision, The Spirit of a Generation, published by Backbeat Books, and has an introduction by Jerry Garcia and commentary by Richie Havens. Elliot Landy is one of the first music photographers to be recognized as an artist. He is an author of 6 photographic books. His images have been exhibited in major museums and galleries throughout the world. His photographs have appeared on the covers of major magazines such as Life, the Saturday Evening Post, and Rolling Stone, and in all the media internationally for the past 40 years. Now, that's really an abbreviated introduction to there. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Elliot.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to hear all this. It's lovely that this goes over the air.
Well, in the dedication to Woodstock Vision, you say what I believe was the key factor of what that vision was or is. And it says, I'm going to quote you here, "May God, the universal experience, expand your conception of happiness to include helping those near you who need help, and may communication bring all of us on this planet closer together, closer to God, and closer to each other," end quote. Now, you wrote this in August 1994. Is that how you felt in August 1969?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the key words here that I think are universal experience, helping those who need help. And boy, that was kind of like a prediction right there, right? Communication of all of us. But it brings us, of course, closer to God, closer to each other. Now, and I believe that's what Aquarius is all about, Elliot.
Yes, it is. It's an age of clarity, of truthfulness, and certainly a vision. And the theory is, I don't know who your listeners are. You know, I don't know if you have mentioned the age of Aquarius and the various cosmological ages, I guess you'd call it.
Well, certainly we have. We've been held guilty of that for the past 22 years since we started radio. So they know about it, but I'm certain they'd rather listen to you.
Well, for me in the 60s, I was 27 years old during this time period when Woodstock happened. And I started out wanting to make the world a better place by stopping the Vietnam War. I'd always, in my innermost feelings, wanted to help people. I enjoyed helping people, being nice to people. And that segued to when I grew up, you know, what am I going to do in life? And I figured I'd be a photographer because I enjoyed photography and only one other thing, which was going out with girls, you know. And I said, well, I can't live from going out with girls. So I just very innocently decided to be a photographer. And I started to take pictures of peace demonstrations. I decided I wanted to do what I could to stop the Vietnam War and realized I didn't want to go to Vietnam, which was my first thought, because I didn't want to be in war. So my second thought was, well, I would take pictures of demonstrations. And I did that. I started working with the underground newspapers, the RAT and New York Free Press. I tried to bring my pictures to the mainstream media, but they weren't interested in them. There was very little coverage of the anti-war demonstrations that were going on. There were a lot of them in New York, and they got like a third of a paragraph on the 25th page, something like that. So in those days, music was part of the underground culture, rock and roll music, rather. When you went to a concert, the musicians were against the war. The audience was against the war. We were against the normal way that life was carried on, which had resulted in the war. And we were trying to make things better, trying to allow for abortion rights, women's rights, and human justice, and make the economic system better. These were all the goals of that generation. And so I was part of that for a while. And I then discovered after the fact that I was more of a photographer than anything else, that it was a photograph and the photography that was what really drew me, that what made me vibrate, so to speak. And once I had photographed the peace demonstrations and saw what they were, my experience of that was over. My desire to do that was over. Once I had photographed the musicians, no matter who they were, how famous they were, from Bob Dylan on down, let's say, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, as far as being famous people, it didn't interest me to do it again and to continue doing that. And then I discovered spiritual books. By spiritual books, I mean metaphysical spiritual books. One of the things that turned me around and changed my life was the words or the thought were that if you're against something, you've lost. If you spend your time fighting with something, then you've been defeated. They've won. If you're fighting against something, it's beaten you. And I thought, that's strange, because, you know, this is what we want to do. We want to fight against the war. We want to fight against the government. you know, to change. I don't mean to, you know, be a terrorist or anything. And I thought, that's strange. And it said that they've won because they've taken all your time. Instead of doing positive things that you would want to do normally, you're spending all your time being against what's negative rather than for what's positive. And that thought changed my life, that understanding, because my conscience was feeling, well, you have to do something to stop all this stuff. But then I realized that, well, what you do is you work on the positive, not against the negative. And that became kind of the guiding vision of my life, I would say, not to be against things, but to be for things.
Well, that is really, in my opinion, the key to what so many great spiritual teachers have taught for millenniums. There are ways to transform, they would call it alchemy or transformation in one way or the other, instead of just hitting it right on and bringing and trying to bring it down in a negative confrontational way. Because as we see today, there's a lot of confrontation on certain things that the fundamentalists or the far right are heaping upon this particular president. And I believe that that's the reason why they're doing it, because they have been, they think of themselves as being kind of defeated, so they're going to get back one way or the other.
I think they were always, I mean, not that I'm the most political person, but I started paying attention during this election because things were getting so bad. I mean, I always paid a little bit of attention. That's not true. I've been reading the Times, I guess, regularly, New York Times, for 10, 12 years again, where there was a period in my life where I didn't even know what Watergate was while it was happening. So I have come back kind of to the mainstream of political thought. But the right, or the conservative people, are always aggressive, regardless of what. They were aggressive during Clinton. Look what they did to this poor man over stuff that they do all the time themselves, you know, over nothing. Nothing that had any political meaning to it. And they were always aggressive. I don't think it's just Obama. I think it's the nature of this kind of thought. It's a very, I don't know, it's a very discriminatory, very self-supporting way of thinking. I won't get into a whole discussion of it. But it seems to go with the territory, this kind of anger, control, and abusive control behavior. Conservative thought is very selfish.
I'm afraid, but you're right. You're right. The same struggle has been happening in another area of the world in regards to American symbols, in which the reason why I got involved in spending a little bit of time with Hendrix and the Doors and people like that back in 1968 was talking about symbols and consciousness. You probably knew Hendrix pretty well.
I didn't know him well. I actually didn't know. I spent a tiny bit of time with him at a press conference. I really didn't know him well at all. I gathered from being with him what he was like. I felt like I saw who he was, let's put it like that.
Yeah.
But I can't say that I knew him. I knew Bob Dylan at the time somewhat. I can't say, well, who knows anybody? Who knows Dylan well anyway? But Hendrix, I didn't really spend that much time with.
Well, his consciousness, he was very much interested in the pyramid and the eye and the triangle.
Yeah, no, I understand that, yes.
And we would spend time sometimes at a little New York place. My God, the scene owned by...
Oh, the scene. Oh, I forgot about that.
Oh, yeah. Paul, I've forgotten his last name, but owned it.
No, Paul was his last name. Steve Paul?
Yes, I think you're right.
Steve
Paul,
I think
that's right. And he would, Hendrix sometimes would carry his little notebooks around and I compared mine, he showed me his, and we talked about the pyramid, the eye, and the triangle. And then later on, when I shared this information with some other people who were in the rock and roll, they said, you know, I don't remember Hendrix ever being interested in this particular area. And since, you know, at that time, at the scene, you didn't have cameras. You didn't have people. You know, it was the kind of a place where everyone was jamming all the time. But fortunately, when I talked to his sister, Janie Hendrix, about a year or so ago, we actually found some of his drawings done in 1968 of the pyramid and the eye and the triangle, and in Hebrew.
Oh, really?
He was, of course, looking. We also talked a little bit about the Kabbalah. And so it was just extraordinary to see these. And when I showed them, I have not been able to catch up to some of my old friends from 40 years ago to say, look, here it is. I mean, you don't have to believe me. Yes, he was into this.
Wow. It was, you know, I would believe that from knowing him, from seeing him, because he was so humble.
Yep.
And he was so much not in what was happening. He was looking on some of the pictures I have. You see him filming the press back, not just being filmed by the press and reveling in being a star. He was active and he was filming them. And he was so gracious to everybody and such a sweet man. He really was. And it was clear that he was seeing what was happening from another level than what most of the people there were on. I mean, that was my overall impression of him, very clearly so. So it's interesting that your exchange with him, your experience with him, is also another piece to his puzzle.
Well, he was an extraordinary soul, no two ways about it. I'm sorry I didn't know him very long, because after being backstage for a couple of months, I had it. I mean, I couldn't tolerate it.
Well, why is that?
Well, what it was that there was a lot of highfalutin good ideas. And whether or not the guys who were responsible allegedly for the ideas lived them, that was another story. And I didn't want to get hung up on the games that are played backstage.
Exactly right.
I found it deprecating, especially to women. I found it really, and that was a very unpopular thing to say. I do, or I even act like women were shoved in the back all the time. But in 2009, we have seen the growth of the divine feminine, which has drastically altered the roles of men and women. But as you noted in your work, and this is again one of the reasons why this book is so important, how did the 60s emancipate men's creative and feminine side?
Just by bringing people closer to life, to freedom, to be able to live freely. The problem with the culture, with the Western civilization culture, is that you weren't allowed to be yourself. You weren't taught to tune in and turn on to life. You were taught you had to be a certain way. You had to do certain things. You had to dress a certain way. The values were you had to make money. You didn't have to do what feels good. In some of the Eastern cultures, you can go off and meditate. Meditation is honored. In school, when I grew up, if you were daydreaming, which is a form of meditation, what are you dreaming about? You were yelled at. You were shocked back to physical reality. For myself, I never had any sense of anything more than a striving for physical achievement until I started smoking grass, I'm sorry to say, I took some diet pills in college. That was the beginning for me, because I had to stay up late, to study for my exams, which I really wasn't interested in. So I started taking some diet pills, nothing serious at all. And that kind of got me to write poetry. It kind of jerked me away from the everyday consciousness, from the everyday attitude towards life, which is just, eat, drink, and make money. Mm-hmm. And there's more to it than that. We weren't taught. And spirituality and the spirituality are taught doesn't make sense. It says we should worship things that don't exist, whatever religion you have. I was born into a Jewish household. That made no more sense to me than the other religions that I know about that permeate our life. That's not to say that any religion is necessarily the right one or better than any other one. To me, there's a certain spiritual essence to life that transcends them all, and to which all religions, from which all religions come. To me, the people that they honor for founding various religions had a hit. They said, oh, this is the way to life, and this is right, and this is the truth. And they were right, because there are many truths in life. After I stopped doing the rock and roll work, and for the same reasons that you just described, by the way, the music business turned me off, and the essence and the some of the personalities of some of the musicians themselves turned me off, and the way I was treated turned me off. And here I was doing what I felt was this very pure thing, and I was always had to fight for money that was owed to me and contracts. And I didn't even do contracts. I didn't have any contracts with anybody. But I was just turned off by exactly what you said backstage, that the essence of it was not the same as the vision of it, as the goal of it, as the idealism of it. And eventually, I found out about the existence of metaphysical spiritual books. And I was convinced by various circumstances, I think too long for this show, that they were true, that there's a book called the I Ching, which can be used as a book of divination, and you throw three coins or you throw yarrow sticks, and it kind of predicts the future, just like the tarot does in a way, predict the future. And I found out that the I Ching worked. It was quite amazing, actually. And I read about Edgar Cayce. Edgar Cayce was, I don't know, do your listeners know who he was?
Oh, certainly. We've had his family on. Edgar Evans Cayce joined us many times. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. So I found out about Edgar Cayce, and he said in one of his readings that the purpose of life is to help people. And I thought, I've always felt that. I never articulated it. But to me, that was clearly the right purpose of life. Mm-hmm. And I found out about the book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly Palmer Hall.
Yeah.
And I saw that, and I said, my God, this stuff has existed throughout history, you know, this kind of thinking. You know, I just want to mention there's a reprint of that a publisher on the West Coast, I don't know the exact name of the publisher, but the man, I met the man, and sent me a copy of it. It's quite nice. Anyway, so I found out that this stuff had existed. It proved itself to me because I had certain experiences, and I decided that I wanted to do a bookstore. I wanted to make a spiritual bookstore so people would know about this work. So I opened up what was going to be a combination photographic gallery and spiritual bookstore as a way out of the connection, as a way to earn money, because I always had to earn money. As a way to earn money without being part of the music business. I just didn't like it. And I was just turned off very, very turned off by the intrusion of business and people's personal attitudes, let's say, into the purity of art as I was living it at the time. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want anything more to do with it. We were talking about spirituality being the essence and not any one religion has the key to it. So when I was sitting up there, I was, of course, looking and, you know, going through all the books. That was the reason I had the bookstore. And people would come up and tell me about what their interests were. And I remember that one person came up and told me about Gurdjieff and Ouspensky. Ouspensky wrote about Gurdjieff, right?
Yeah.
And the teaching of Gurdjieff. Now, that's an area of wisdom, information, spirituality that just did not interest me. I looked at the books. I didn't vibrate with it. It didn't mean anything to me at all. There are other areas that meant a lot, but that particular. But this person was obviously so nice, and so clear, and so intelligent, and told me how this had led him to the path of truth in his life, and was directing his spirituality. And from that conversation, I realized that it's all just spokes on the wheel, that there are many ways to the center. To the essence of what life is. And each way, whether it be Christianity, Gurdjieff, Taoism, Kabbalah, is just another way. And in each life, because I believe in multiple past life experiences, in each life we're attracted, we need to learn different things in different ways. And each way is just another way of doing it. And neither is better nor worse than any other one. It's just different. And that was a pretty interesting moment for me when I realized that, because I would have normally put that area down, still having old habits from growing up, you know. I said, I don't care for that. It doesn't say anything. It's not very good. But I saw that for him, it was his way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly, you elevated the consciousness in that particular area of the people that came into the store and gave them hope that human beings all have a special reason for being born, a special purpose, and that when you look within over a period of time, you may discover that purpose. And then certainly the next time you come around, maybe we'll all do a lot better. Time for a break here on 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Elliot Landy, rock and roll celebrity photographer, whose beautiful new book, Woodstock Visions, is available from Hal Leonard Backbeat Books, wherever fine books are sold. Learn more about it at www.landyvision.com. We'll be right back.
Radio 680 WCBM.
Hi, this is Janie Hendricks, sister of Jimi Hendricks, and you are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Before we go any further, I'd like to say, man, y'all really had a lot of patience. 3 days worth. You proved to the world what can happen. A little bit of love and understanding in sounds.
This is 21st Century Radio, and I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. We're listening to an interview we recorded with photographer Elliot Landy, whose deeply insightful book, Woodstock Visions, is available from Hal Leonard Backbeat Books, wherever fine books are sold. Check out the excellent photographs at www.landyvision.com. Another good thing about your work. There are so many good things about it. You're going to get tired of hearing me saying positive things.
Well,
so.
No, you are really addressing what's closest to my heart, which is the spirituality and the essence of the time, because that's why I did that book, Woodstock 69, the first festival. That was done in 94, and I collected the text and did some interviews myself to reflect the essence of the Woodstock, of the experience of the Woodstock Festival, what the time was about, and what the manifestation of Woodstock Festival meant. And I did that because I wanted that to last. And at the time, I collected pictures from 11, 12 other photographers. I had planned to reprint that book as it was, ran into so much business difficulty. It's unbelievable. It's still reverberating the problems I've had and with trying to reprint the book. And my wife, wise as she is, said to me, why don't you just take the text? Because it was the text in that book that was most meaningful to me. The pictures were kind of interchangeable, but the text I had collected to say something. And she said, why don't you take the text and make it part of your book and put in your own Woodstock pictures? You've got enough pictures of Woodstock to sustain, you know, the whole thing yourself. So I went to Hal Leonard, which is Backbeat Books, this very nice man, John Cerullo, who's the editor-in-chief. He actually has his own Buddhist publishing company. But he's the chief editor of Hal Leonard, which is the largest music publisher in the country, music book publisher, and they do CDs and everything. And the minute I said that to him, because he had been interested in the book anyway, he said, that's a great idea. He says, let's do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says, take 150. He says, take as many pages as you want. And I said, well, you know, what do you mean? He said, oh, you know, just as many as you want. I said, well, I think 150 will be good. And he said, okay. And then I got into doing it because I had to relay out everything myself. And then it got to 170, 180, and then 190. It kept going up. So it finally ended at 224 when he said, no, if we go any higher than that, we have to make the book too expensive. So it stopped at 224. But all the text from Woodstock 69, the first festival, is the second half of Woodstock Vision, the Spirit of a Generation. And it's one book, and I really feel that it's nice. And it's so nice to hear you say how meaningful that book was to you, because it was certainly meaningful to me. I really did it for the purpose of sharing my vision, my thought, what I felt was the truth about the time.
Well, it just became obvious to me that you understood the underpinnings of consciousness, and the standpoint is that our planet, not just America, not just Woodstock, is moving in this direction. And as you pointed out wisely, you said that, you know, that things get started and then they kind of like putter out, and there's got to be reasons for those things, because not everyone can handle it all at once. And so here we are 40 years later, and I think now it becomes very obvious that it was really about consciousness. And when I would say that some years ago, and people would laugh at it and say, oh, it was really about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Well, that was part of it, but that was a small part as far as I was concerned. But I wasn't there, you know, but a lot of my friends went. When I heard there was going to be 50,000 people, and I had already been spoiled because, you know, once you go or backstage with these guys, and I was thinking, hey, maybe if I go up there, I'll see Jimmy and we'll continue that conversation. I wouldn't have been able to get near them up there. You got to have all kinds of credentials to do that. And I decided 50,000 people was a little bit much for me. And so I went home, and then we founded schools that ended up being accredited as the first esoteric study center in our country.
Really?
But that's the thing that I really wanted to talk to him again about, because of that. But I never would have been able to talk to him, period. You know, how could you get close to him unless you had the right badge? I didn't know Michael Lang. I didn't know any of the other guys. So that really would have caused the problem. Now, but there is another interesting area here, how the use of herbs and the breaking down of barriers. You say drugs were a part of that interconnectedness, but they were light, non-addicting, consciousness-raising natural herbs which helped us attain higher states. In some ways, drugs work similarly, as you said here, to meditation, but there's a difference between using a drug and doing it on your own. What might the difference be?
it's a different kind of experience. When you do a deep meditation, your whole being is actually altered, and drugs alter a little bit of it. They're a little bit superficial. They alter your mind. And it's terrific while you're high, but then they go away, and it's not as deep. When you do meditation, your vibration, your vibration is altered. When you do it continuously, God, we have to go deeper than that into it to explain it. But
can I quote you from your book?
Yeah.
Drugs were a window to that vision, but there was a price to pay. When drugs are used to reach the highs, one is less capable of dealing graciously with the lows and responds negatively to situations that could be handled better. That is the best explanation I have ever seen.
Wow.
In regards to the difference between, you know, when you come down, because you're in an elevated awareness, and then you come down, and it is a bit disappointing to be back in the physical.
Yeah.
And that has to affect your vision. And I think you made it so clear in this work. Now, you love photography. Why?
Well, are we going to past lives? Or
yes, you can, because that would
first
be terrific.
First, I just want to address one thing we said before. You said that the 60s were about spirituality and consciousness, but other people say, no, it was about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but that sex, drugs, and rock and roll is part of learning. And it is, they are windows, just as we spoke about a minute ago. And by drugs, I'm not talking about hard drugs. I'm talking about expansion, mind expansion, consciousness expanding drugs. Like throughout history and now, indigenous peoples use herbal substances to expand their minds, to see what else is there besides the tree and the woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
There's other stuff that we can't physically see. So this is a standard thing. The fact that these kind of consciousness, light, non-addictive drugs, I mean, coffee is more addictive than marijuana, and tobacco is certainly, you know, hugely more addictive, as is, I don't know about alcohol and so on, but actually to some people alcohol is more addictive, so like American Indians and things like that. I think people really get addicted to that stuff. But the laws are unfair, and the laws are not based on reason. That's what I mean by unfair. And the reason that Woodstock happened was that the government stayed away. New York State police didn't come in and bust people for smoking, you know, and there weren't hard drugs. I mean, of course there are everywhere, but, you know, there's also people that get grossly fat from overheating and sick from eating too much sugar and smoking too much and so on and so forth. But, you know, if you do things in moderation, and if you're taught that the reason for doing this is to see the rest of the world, and then to bring that back to your everyday life. If you are aware that there's more to life, that there's a greater feeling to be had by being loving than being selfish, by sharing than accumulating, then and you just say, give it a chance. Like, I don't believe things just because I hear them. I think one book I used to sell in my bookstore was called the Secrets of Tibetan Mysticism, something like that, by she was the first woman to go to the East and uncover all these mystical secrets, and it's called The Secret Doctrine.
Oh, Helen Blavatsky.
Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky.
Oh, yes.
And her real name was Neil or something.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes,
yeah.
Yeah, it was
Madame Blavatsky. Yes, right. And in that it says that the deepest, most mystical teaching of the Tibetan mystical school is don't believe anything unless it vibrates true within yourself. Mm-hmm. No matter who's saying it, whether it's supposed to come directly from God, from his high priest, from the smartest person in the world. Of course, I'm paraphrasing it. Listen to it, accept it, try it out, but if it doesn't feel right, then reject it. He says, unless you believe it, it's not valid for your own life and for yourself. Doesn't mean it won't be valid for somebody else, but don't believe things just on faith. Listen to things on faith and then try it out within yourself, within your own life. And to me, that's a very interesting point, because all young people are brought up, oh, the priest said that, the rabbi said that, the guru said that, the monk said that, Tibetan Buddhism thinks this way. Hinduism thinks that way, the Dalai Lama, the Kali Rinpo, you know, whoever they are. And these are all good people. I'm not putting any of them down at all. I'm just saying that you have to judge for yourself whether you think it's valid. There is no higher authority than yourself. That was the deepest teaching of Tibetan mysticism, according to her, as I remember reading it. So the sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing were all part of learning. It was a way of getting away from normal physical experience and going further. And the idea of rock and roll in the 60s was transcendence. Mm-hmm. And it tried to do it. And some people going to these communal experiences, which were what rock and roll concerts were in those days, I guess they still are, I don't go to them now, was that it was a transcendent experience.
Well, time for another transcendent experience now, because it's break time on 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Elliot Landy, and we're talking about his new book, Woodstock Visions. Check out his website at landyvision.com. When we come back, we'll hear more about those celebrity press parties of the 1960s, so don't go away. WCBM. Gene Leitner of Maryland's Golden Radio Buffs returns for a summer special of old-time radio, so warm up the old Philco and tune in for one of my all-time favorite shows. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Hey, this is Ziggy Marley saying love, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. One love, y'all.
Sorry for the tune-up between time, but for hell, Cowboys is the only one to stay in tune anyway, you know, so what the hell.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our guest is photographer Elliot Landy. You will love this exquisite new photography book, and not just for the photos, but also for his memories of each of his encounters with the celebrity subjects. Visit him online at www.landyvision.com. Well, I'm going to backtrack just a little bit here. In 1967, you wanted to take pictures that explain the truth to people and present them with alternatives, and as you already noted, what you learned is when you took the photographs of that documented police brutality, they didn't want to use them at all, except within some of the underground papers. And of course, any underground paper has its own biases, as we all know. And then when the photographs, the ridiculousness of the celebrity press parties and the star culture and its hero worship, prize and awards, and contrived media coverage were apparent not only to you, but some of the stars themselves, like Dustin Hoffman. Would you review the experience with Dustin at one of those particular events?
Yes, it's interesting. I didn't get any great pictures of him, as I did of some of the other people. And by great pictures, I mean interesting things. I went to these celebrity parties. I was a young photographer. I was just starting out. I was looking for a way to make money, and I was trying to find out about life, and I wanted to meet famous people like everyone else does. You know, the famous actors you grew up with or whatever. I figured it'd be nice to see them close up and meet them and so on. So I started to, and also I was hoping to make money from taking pictures at these parties and selling them to magazines. So I went there, and I was able to go there because the underground newspapers I was working with had New York City police press passes, which gets you in anywhere. It used to get you in anywhere. Anyway, it was an official thing that they doled out very carefully. So I would go to these press parties, and I tried to take nice pictures. I wasn't going there to make fun of them. I was going there to take nice pictures. But what was happening in front of my camera was very funny. And my camera has never allowed me to lie. It's very interesting. It comes through the truth, or the essence comes through despite myself sometimes, even if I don't see it. I then see it when I look at the pictures. And at these parties, all these funny things were happening. And I published a lot more in this book, in this revision of the book, than I have before. And I love this series of photographs. I think it's quite incredible. And it really showed how vacant, how vapid a celebrity culture is. Instead of honoring the philosophers and the thinkers and the writers and the intellects and the true artists, we honor people just because they're beautiful or just because they know how to act. Now, we can honor them because they do that, but it doesn't mean we need to listen to them or be interested in their personal lives. Go to a movie, go to a play, enjoy it, and then pay attention to what's important and, you know, what is has deeper meaning in life, let's say. And it doesn't mean that it's bad to look at their personal lives, but the extreme influence that this kind of media has on our daily life is atrocious. It was then, and it's gotten worse, and it still is. And it really stops us from thinking about, gee, now what can this country do to stop blindness in India, you know, which Baba Ram Dass's foundation, the Shiva Foundation it is?
That, I think so.
It's something that Ram Dass and another person, I should know who they are, I'm sorry. I think he's involved with Google now, actually, founded, and Wavy Gravy's involved with it, Hugh Romney. So because we're thinking about this side stuff, the sideshow, let's say, you know, we're not focused on the main event here as people.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we focus on the main event, I think the happier we can be, really. So anyway, so that's what happened. So when I just remember meeting Dustin Hoffman, who actually was a friend of my girlfriend at the time, and we talked a little bit, and he was just saying, oh, this is so stupid to be here, and I really can't quote him anymore. But he was very uncomfortable being there. He was very clear that he didn't want to be there, that he didn't want to be part of the charade, I guess, because
mm-hmm.
everyone there was there only for the publicity, only for the self-promotion. They weren't at something they would really like to be at. They had probably had better ways they want to spend their time. But they were doing it, you know, to further their career. And he was just very clear about it, just like Jimi Hendrix was very clear about what was going on there. And, I mean, you know, Dustin wasn't negative. He wasn't putting it down. He was just clear about it. And I haven't spoken to him since that time. But I remember, you know, just being very also impressed with his sense of truth.
Well, to illustrate what you've said, I'm going to hold up your book to my microphone here. We've got some advanced souls out there to take a look at Marlene Dietrich hiding from photographers and flashbulbs. And when you see the faces on them, just a look at – here, take a look at Elizabeth Taylor here. See? She doesn't look like she's having the best time of her life.
And
then there's Faye Dunaway, but there's a one I cannot pronounce her name because I don't know much about Miss Gingold.
Hermione Gingold.
That picture says all kinds of stuff to me.
Amazing?
It is, yeah.
I've laid that picture out next to almost every one of the photographs in that section. Like, her attitude speaks to every single photograph. You can't do it in the book unless you tear the pages out. I can do it because I have prints. But maybe I'll put up something on the web at some point with that picture next to every other picture. Because when you see that picture, actually, you know what I tell people? If you buy the book, make a print of that. Like, scan it or make a good Kinko photocopy. I hereby give universal permission to everyone, every Kinko's and photocopy place in the world to photocopy that picture, and put that picture next to every other picture in that section. In that, I call it Hollywood Peace,
mm-hmm.
Hollywood Celebrities and Peace Demonstrations. And it works with every picture. It says something about every picture. So it's a great, you know, it's very interesting photograph.
It sure is. I've stopped and gone back to it many times, uh-huh. watching the people behind her, realizing the kind of consciousness that's involved there. So your pictures reflected the falseness and the superficiality of those events. That's
yeah.
not what we were trying to do, really.
No.
But you
the humor of it, too.
And
it was ultimately funny in the end.
And
you know, for some reason they came out funny. You know, there's a look on it. On an older woman's face, probably younger than I am now, where she sees this young Hollywood would-be starlet. And I can't say Hollywood, this young show business woman dressed up in white frills or whatever, posing in a very kind of funny way. She's got a funny pose. And the woman is posing for the photographers, and this older woman who's way beyond this in years just turned around looking at what's happening, you know, going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just catches. I really love that series, and they haven't gotten it. They almost never published, and, you know, they haven't gotten much attention, but I hope at some point in my life that they will, because it came out, you know, it came out quite nice. As a matter of fact, when I was friendly with Bob Dylan, he looked at that series and he said, "Oh, you know, you want to do a book about this? You know, I'd like, you know, I could put words to this, or we could do a book together with these pictures, both the peace demonstration and the Hollywood celebrity pictures." And at the time, I said to him, "If it's right." And he said to me, "What do you mean if it's right?" You know, and the reason I said if it's right was because I had kind of crossed the path about being positive and not negative. I crossed the bridge, let's say, and where I had read about, you know, that be positive, not negative, and so on. And I thought, well, because they don't really show people in the best light. You know, they're not of beautiful things per se. They're kind of absurd photographs, and they're, you know, and they show negative. They show police brutality and this and that. And they show, although not very heavy police brutality. So I said that to him, you know, and he looked at me not understanding that, kind of disagreeing with it. And I look back at that thought, and I love the, all I know is my feeling is I love the picture, I love to look at them. They don't do anybody harm anymore. At the time, I guess the people in them were still at that same age. So maybe they would have had a more negative impact than they will now. I mean, they're not negative pictures.
They're not.
It's funny.
But
they're really not.
But
I was looking for flowers and babies in my life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to that
time.
Later on. You got to that, and there's
yes,
gorgeous shots at the end we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
But as you know, your camera, you are kind of like, well, here's how you put it. Your camera taught you about what you were seeing. And you also discovered what you've referred to as, quote, the grace of chance.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about the grace of chance?
Well,
because it seems like you were channeling with your camera, if you don't mind my saying.
It's being in the flow. What channeling is being in the flow and being connected. Of course, I didn't realize it at the time, but I understand it now. In public events like that, there's a lot of jostling and there's police lines and you can't get to the front. There were a lot of photographers at the celebrity events we're talking about now. So what I would do is I just hold the camera up over my head without looking through the lens, you know, as high up as I can get it, point it down and click the shutter and hope I was getting something. And as you'll see in the book, or all these pictures, by the way, are on my website, which is landyvision.com, and they're free on the website, so you don't need to buy the book to experience it. So I would hold the camera over my head with a wide-angle lens. I had a 28-millimeter lens at the time, and point it. And some of the pictures, as you'll see in the book, are so perfectly composed, like you get the guy's eyeball at the very edge of the film frame, and that makes the photograph. This is one of Elizabeth Taylor. And you get this person off in the back that you would never even think to photograph, but because they're there, that makes the photograph. So I saw that I didn't have to control everything, that I can just allow myself to be pushed forward by the crowd, pushed back by the crowd, and just wherever I was, I did what I was able to do, and then that was really perfection. That worked out perfectly, gave me what I considered a perfect image. Now, that image is not what they would want to put on the cover of a celebrity magazine at all, but for me, the photographer, the person who loves a beautiful visual that's different, it was the perfect picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The grace of chance.
And I discovered that, yes, and I discovered that that chance is as important as anything else in life, which was where the I Ching took me also, you know, about, you know, a year or two later when I got into that. It also is about chance, as is tarot. You know, what cards you pick, you turn over, and so on, are quite amazing.
Yes, indeed, they are, aren't they?
How that works. And that showed me that there was another layer of life beyond the layer that my mind perceives, sound and vision and thought, that there was something else going on, kind of pulling strings around us.
Yeah.
And I really feel I felt there was, and you know, people would say there are guides and so on, and I guess that's what it is. I perceive the manifestation of those metaphysical, beyond physical forces or energies at that time. That was kind of my introduction to it.
Well, as a matter of fact, friends, we'll be back with more of Elliot Landy after the news break. And then at 9:30, don't miss our live interview with the sister of Jimi Hendrix, Janie, who is joining us to talk about the new film. Actually, it's a DVD, two DVD set called Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock. And we're playing clips from this film throughout both hours of tonight's show. And this is, of course, 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. And also, let me tell you about what's happening next week. Next week, your guest host will be Gene Leitner, Golden Radio Buffs of Maryland, with old-time radio programs and memories. As you know, I just love old-time radio. I'm looking forward to hearing Uncle Gene again. And then on August the 9th, we return with another, this is the 40th anniversary special, Woodstock special. The guests will include Fred Weintraub, the Warner Brothers executive who green-lighted the Woodstock film. It almost didn't happen. He made sure it did. Eddie Kramer, sound engineer in charge of the recording of the Woodstock concert. Boy, wait till you hear his story. And, of course, there will be a number of others. And on Sunday, hour two, next, that is August the 9th, Paul Kingsbury, co-editor of Woodstock, 3 Days That Rocked the World, Sterling Publishing. What an extraordinary book that is. Then, finally, August the 16th, Ziggy Marley returns, a Grammy Award winner, on his new children's album, Family Time, featuring friends like Willie Nelson and Paul Simon. We'll be right back.
Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore.
From ABC News, I'm Brad Wheeler. Some economists believe.